Hey, everybody, I'd like to welcome you all to Flap Operator Extraordinaire, the debut of my new podcast, talking about airplanes, everything airplanes, and everything airlines, some funny jokes, some serious things. So welcome aboard, and let's get started. This is the first episode of what I hope is going to turn into a short series that a few of you out there may end up enjoying. This is, like I said, the first episode of my first ever podcast. So there's going to be some learning together, some adjustment period, but hopefully it'll be a good time for everybody, and we can talk a lot about airplanes. My name is Pilot Chris. I'm a 23-year-old first officer at a regional airline flying a 50-seat commuter jet. I fly the CRJ-200, which is the 50-seat variant of the Canadair regional family. They've got CRJ 700, 900, and I believe now the CRJ 1000, so the smallest of those four types of aircraft family. But I got my start flying something much smaller than the CRJ 200. I started flying when I was 15, started taking flying lessons when I was just a wee lad in the summer between the freshman and sophomore years. I was in high school. I had a friend of mine who had Microsoft Flight Simulator at his house when I was much younger, about 13, really developed an interest in aviation, played the game every single day and night. I think he gave it to me one night, and I took it home, installed it on my mom's laptop, I believe, and sat in front of the computer screen for hours and hours, you know, demanded that somebody buy me a joystick, and then I just became a recluse. Did all the flight lessons and stuff on the flight simulator, log time, sat in front of the computers. You know, people didn't see me for days and days sometimes, just doing everything airplane related I could. It really became a passion for me at that point. And then when I was 15, I finally got around to bugging my parents on how I could take flying lessons. And fortunately, they're very loving. If they're listening, hi, Mom, hi, Dad. I'm very fortunate. Thank you guys so much for being wonderful parents and really encouraging my passion and fueling my ability to do the job that I love and able to do today. So at 15, I started taking flying lessons. I was fortunate enough to be able to solo on my 16th birthday in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, actually at the Oshkosh Airport where the EAA air show is held every year down there at good old Air Venture. Able to just really enjoy the experience. I was on my 16th birthday, which made it even that much better. Then when I turned 17, I was able to obtain my private pilot certificate when I was a senior in high school, which was really special for me. I was very proud of myself, just really motivated to get that done, really wanted to be a real pilot. I had thought about doing the sport pilot certificate, had some encouragement from a mentor of mine to do the sport certificate, but I think I always knew that I was destined to fly the heavy iron, so to speak, and that I needed a real pilot certificate to do that. So then I went to my local tech school, to a technical college, where I did 2 years of training in a professional pilot training program. I got a lot of good experience there, flying 172s and Cessna Beechcraft, Beechcraft Duchesses. Two of them did all of my ratings, got my commercial instrument, CFI, IIMEI. Did that when I was 18 and 19. Then I got hooked up with a charter operation after doing a couple of months of flight instruction, also in Wisconsin. Flew charter for about 9 months until I got 880 or so hours. Some of that flying turbine, some of it just piston twins. And fortunately, the headquarters for my airline was very nearby. So I went out with my lovely mother and bought the best suit that Kohl's department store had to offer. And I stood in the lobby until somebody took notice of the scared-looking teenager in the corner who was about as nervous as could possibly be and asked what I was doing there. So long story short, that's kind of how I got started in aviation. From a very early age, just been very passionate about airplanes. I don't really know why. You know, I asked myself why I wanted to do this podcast, and I just thought that I could give a perspective that isn't really discussed in aviation, nobody likes to talk about the little guy. There's not a lot of discussion from the right seat, from the co-pilot's point of view. You know, there's a lot of really great stories floating around out there about not necessarily stories, but people who are still alive. You know, not just the great, you know, war heroes and you know, fighter pilots and stuff that we pilots kind of fantasize or romanticize about, hearing these old, you know, World War II P-51 Mustang dogfighting stories. But you know, guys who got 25,000 hours flying 747s from here to, you know, London and flying in Asia and all over, they got really great experience. But I just thought I could give a perspective in modern aviation from the bottom, from the trenches, so to speak. Kind of give a perspective from my point of view. And I've got some friends who are in several different stages in their careers. Flight instructors, one of them is in college, one of them is a flight instructor, moving into being a commercial pilot. Another one is an airline pilot who's been doing a little bit longer than I have. And I just thought it'd be nice if perhaps I could have some guests later on and we could pick a topic and kind of discuss aviation and where we think it's going from our point of view, and try and talk a little bit to all those aspiring aviators and first officers out there about how to get to the airlines, you know, what life is like here, what you can expect, and how to move forward. So that's what I'm trying to do here, I think, on this podcast. I just thought I could do it, and I thought I could just share my experiences and hopefully tell some funny stories, tell some kind of sobering stories, and just share. I also, at my regional airline, I work as a CPT instructor. That stands for Cockpit Procedures Training. It's a four-day part of initial pilot training between the in-doc and systems portion, the month they spend at the headquarters of my airline, learning all about the procedures and the manuals of the company, and then they learn about the systems of the airplane, the nuts and the bolts of how it actually operates, you know, how the flaps go up and down, what makes the gear swing, you know, in and out of the bay, you know, so on and so forth, how the airplane pressurizes, systems class, and then they come to me for 4 days. We sit in front of a poster basically and pretend to push buttons, and we chair fly and we talk about procedures and we go through callouts and profiles, mm-hmm. Run checklists, and just kind of introduce people who are not familiar with the way that we do things here at the airlines to our operating procedures, and just kind of prepare our new hire students so that they're more successful when they get to the simulator where things actually move and, you know, engines fail and warning bells, you know, are going off constantly. So I thought that would kind of also offer me a unique perspective to try and share perhaps some lessons I've learned through watching my students and things I've learned at the training environment here at my regional airline. Let's see here. I've got a list of things I kind of wanted to talk about. I just like to talk about airplanes. That's the last one. I don't think that I'm overly wise. I don't think I have years and years and years of, well, in fact, I know I don't have years and years and years of aviation experience, but I thought, I just like to talk, you know, I like to, I don't like to lecture, I like to explain, I like to discuss, I like to just kind of tell people why I'm so passionate about what I do and just try and share that passion. It lights me up, kind of a fire inside. I know that sounds funny, but any of my family events, I get together with my family or a gathering of people, and you know, inevitably it comes up that I'm an airline pilot, and somebody in the room goes, "Oh, I've always wondered about you know, blah blah blah, something something question," and my mother, you know, will almost roll her eyes and kind of have to warn the person, "Now be careful, you know, if you get him started, he's going to go on and on." So I thought, what better way than to share my thoughts and feelings than on a podcast where I can just go on and on and on. And, you know, if you don't want to listen to it, you can just hit pause or hopefully enjoy what it is I have to say. And for those of you listening to this, if you would, if you want to, please comment. I would love constructive criticism. You know, tell me if you enjoy it, tell me if you don't, and if you don't enjoy it, tell me if, you know, if there's something I could do to fix it. and maybe some recommendations for topics. What do you want to hear about? What interests you? You have a question from, you know, maybe a flight that you took at some point and you want to answer it, or you want me to talk about, you know, a certain part of aviation, flying, how to get into the airlines, how I did it, maybe even how to start taking flying lessons. You know, I'm a flight instructor. I did that for a while too. I've got friends who are flight instructors who can do some guest commentary. You know, aviation questions in general, you know, silly stuff. I always wondered what that particular sign meant or why the runways were painted the way they were. We can, you know, we can just talk and it can be fun. We'll tell funny stories too. I've got a lot of those, you know, things that have happened at the airlines or even flying charter or flight instructing. That's just fun, you know, good humor, good natured humor, I guess, aviation humor. I don't think there's enough of that. It's a serious business, but, you know, we like to have fun as well, and certainly fun things happen. So this is just a trial. We're gonna talk about some fun things and move forward and hopefully make a couple of episodes and see how things go. So I've got, like I said, some friends whose stories hopefully I can share. I'm going to talk about probably quite a bit in the episodes to come. I'm not going to use their names because they don't even know they're in this yet, but I'm sure if you guys are listening, you'll know who I'm talking about. I've got a friend who's down in Texas right now who went to a well-known aviation university. We actually graduated high school together. Both of the friends I'm going to talk about, I graduated high school with in 2008 in the good old state of Wisconsin. One of them now is graduated from a reputable four-year aviation college. Super sharp guy, great attitude, really, really like talking to him. We talk a couple of times a month on the phone, and they usually end up turning into laughter-filled, you know, two-hour gab sessions where we kind of just get our nerd on and talk about airplanes, what's going on in the world, and really sharp guy, knows his stuff, knows more about airlines than I do sometimes, and he's not even an airline pilot, so hopefully we'll get his perspective. He's just, he was working, doing some flight instructing at one flight school. He's kind of moved on now, is doing, from what I understand, traffic watch, flying around, I guess, looking at the traffic. I don't know. We'll have to get him on the show here and have him tell you what he's doing. And then he's trying to, thinking about doing some volunteering at a simulator facility to possibly get some good contacts in the business aviation world, or get a type rating and a Citation 10 or some fancy Gulfstream at some point. So that's exciting. He's coming up pretty close to getting his ATP minimum. So hopefully we'll be able to see him here at the regionals pretty soon. And I know that he's excited, and we're excited to have him because he's just going to be a fantastic employee. He's got a great attitude, a good worker, and quite a few years left at the business. So the other friend of mine also graduated high school with in 2008 in Wisconsin. All three of us actually knew each other, although we weren't good friends until the later years after college. He started off at a reputable four-year university and ended up kind of diverging from the aviation path, and then later on realized that he did like aviation after all, wanted to pursue it for a career path, and steered back towards college, but in a different direction. He's at a technical school doing the local aviation program, which is great. It's the same way I did it. He's learning how to fly right now and doing his flight instructor training. So he did, he has a commercial pilot certificate, multi-engine instrument ratings, and got some experience this summer that's ending. I guess it's fall now, but he did some photo flying, so he flew around a photographer all over the Midwest, from what it sounds like, doing taking pictures of things. I don't know. I talked to him a couple of times. Hopefully we can get him on the show, and he can share his experiences with you going through college, kind of the big flight school, the little flight school, taking some time off, maybe some soul searching in there, his experiences on flight training. And now as he kind of looks towards the future of getting his flight instructor certificate and what he's going to try and do, where he's going to go to work, how he's going to get his time. It sounds like he wants to be an airline pilot, maybe at some point to try it out. And he's got a little ways to go. He's got probably about, he'll probably graduate with about 200 hours. I don't know, but he's probably got about 125 or so now. No. I stand corrected. He's got about two. He'll have about 250 when he graduates. Probably has about 200 now. He has a commercial certificate. That's right. So, it's going to be interesting to kind of watch his career path. He's a good friend of mine, so I'll probably reference him at some point. Again, I'm not going to name names because I don't think they knew who they are. They don't know that they're in this yet. Last friend of mine I'll probably talk about is he's actually senior to me at my airline. He works at the same company I do. I met him when I was flight instructing for a couple of months. He was the lead flight instructor, kind of managed the office of the flight school that I worked at, again, in Wisconsin. Has become a good friend of mine. He's a few years older than I am. He's got a lot of good experience. He came about a little differently. His path to aviation was more from an entrepreneur, or excuse me, bystander's point of view. I guess he was curious in aviation, wanted to get started, got a certificate. He was doing some other work, teaching and doing some managing and in business a little bit, and kind of got steered into aviation. And now he's now that the airlines kind of picked up in the last couple of years, and he got hired on, oh, I would say 6 months or so, maybe a little bit more than that, before I did at my airline. And he's kind of the reason I ended up at the airline I work for now. So he just informed me on the phone a couple of days ago that he got a job offer from a major airline. Not a job offer, an interview. So it's going to be exciting in the next couple of weeks to hear what happens with him and his interview. And maybe we can get some information from him and have him tell his story about what the interview was like and how he... his path to getting to where he is today. So those are my friends. They're all funny. They're all great. They're all good guys. They're all in aviation at different stages in our careers. So I think I have some fun stories I'll be able to share, some experiences I'll be able to share, and it should be pretty fun. So that's what this is all about, right? All about fun and airplanes. So just a little bit of a background here about the airlines, kind of what I do, just to give you a perspective. For those of you who aren't, even if you're into aviation, who don't necessarily know a lot about the airlines, you know, before I worked for an airline, I found it kind of difficult to understand the aviation or the airline business. It's extremely technical. It's very fast-paced, and it's very, very much closed door. It's hard to get a lot of solid information because it's either proprietary or sensitive security information, especially in the post 9/11 era. So. It's not easy for people to find out about airlines, and I didn't know a whole lot. I luckily wound up at a good company, a good regional airline. There's some that are not maybe so good and some that are better than others based on quality of life kind of stuff. But regionals a little bit. Regional airlines kind of came into the spotlight after Colgan Airlines crashed De Havilland Dash 8 Q400 series turboprop just outside of Buffalo, New York, a couple of years ago. They worked for a regional airline flying 70-seat turboprop airplanes, actually a fairly large turboprop, larger than the jet-powered airplane that I fly. The family members ended up suing Continental Airlines for damages because they believed it was not disclosed to the flying public that even though they bought a ticket on Continental and they got on an airplane that said Continental and the flight attendant said welcome aboard Continental Express or Continental Connection, whatever it may be, that they were actually operating on a different airline, Colgan Airlines. So I just want to point out that the regional carriers, the express carriers, the connection carriers, anything with express or connection on the back of it is, even though it's painted the same color as a regular, is the larger aircraft, are in fact operated by different companies. So I work for a company that's a little smaller, but nowhere near the size of the giants. I do not work for a major airline like, Delta, United, Continental, Delta, Northwest, United, Continental, Southwest, AirTran, American Airlines, U.S. Airways. Those are the large, they're actually legacy carriers. Then we've got the JetBlues, Spirits, so on and so forth. I think I left AirTran out of there. So I work for the regional airlines, the little guys, the commuter jets that are always delayed. so to speak. So the differences are we make a little bit less money. We fly smaller airplanes. We fly longer routes, or excuse me, longer days, typically more legs. We fly 4 to 6 legs a day, whereas a major airline, their crews might only fly 2 or 3 legs a day at the most because they're longer. They might fly 5 or 6 hour legs flights. We call them legs. Or whereas we might fly our typical stage length at my airline is probably in the 45 to 50 minute length. So a lot of short stuff, doing the hops in and out of the big hubs. So flying out to little communities, picking up people and flying them into the big hubs so they can get on the big airplanes and go, you know, over the pond, over the ocean, or transcontinental or wherever it may be. Why work for a regional airline? Sometimes it doesn't sound so good. Why would you do it? It's a stepping stone. It's very hard to work for a major airline. Major airlines want pilots with a lot of experience. They want pilots who have already flown at other airlines so that they know they have what it takes to pass a rigorous training program and to survive in the environment that they're going to be working in. It's pretty stressful sometimes, the training program. It's pretty rigorous. Not everybody is cut out for it, and the company makes a fairly substantial financial commitment in each employee when they hire them. I think I ran some numbers just off the top of my head for my particular airline, and it was in the $25,000 range per employee to go through from date of hire all the way through to actually putting their hands on a real airplane. The company invests $25,000 in every employee. So, you know, for an airline that's trying to staff, you know, 1,000 openings, it's a pretty substantial financial commitment. So the major airlines want you to have some experience so that they know that you have what it takes, the right stuff, so to speak, to survive before they make that commitment in you. So my goals eventually are to get enough experience here at the regionals. That's flight time. So accumulating total flight time and years of service, putting together a good resume, you know, staying in the training department, staying current, doing extracurricular flying activities. I don't think podcasts qualify, but just kind of building my resume, enjoying, you know, life while I do it. Travel benefits, you know, young airline employee. It's there's a lot of benefits to it, which I can address in a later podcast. But my goal is to kind of enjoy what I'm doing right now, get some experience, build a strong resume, and then move on to a major airline. I want to be a wide body captain. I want to fly 300 or 400 or 500 passengers at a time from Chicago O'Hare to London's Heathrow or you know, some similar type of route. And I want to spend a career doing it. I love flying. I love everything about it, and that kind of appeals to me. So that's what I'm moving towards. That's what my interests are. Although I do like small aircraft, I like flying. Fly a Cessna 172 around a lot on the ground on my time off. Excuse me. I donate some time. I do pro bono flying work sometimes. Skydivers, which I don't get paid for. I just do for fun. I like to rent airplanes and take people for rides and just kind of go to fly-ins, air shows, things like that, general aviation, just kind of experience everything there is to do with airplanes. So that's kind of what I'm working towards and my aspirations. A little bit about just kind of what it's like for me on a trip, just kind of explain the regionals. Right now, I'm actually sitting in a hotel room in Syracuse, New York. Actually, one of our nicer crew hotels, a little kitchen and everything in here. It's a one of those extended stay suites. So I suppose you would stay here for quite some time. At least that's what the room's designed for. It's nice for us, though. I get able to cook a little bit and spread out living room in a separate bathroom. Excuse me, bedroom. Makes it a little bit more like home, which is nice, but this is day 2 of a 3-day trip. I was on the road for 3 days, so I left yesterday, flew 4 flights, which we call legs. 4 legs yesterday, 4 legs today, and we do 4 legs tomorrow. All early morning stuff, early morning shows, so getting up at 10 to 4 in the morning. It's East Coast time, so 10 to 4, 3:50 a.m. Get down to the van, get to the airplane. It's cold and dark, fired up. Fly into a hub airport, do what we call a turn. Turn around, fly to an outstation and back to the hub, and then fly one more leg to the outstation where we're going to spend what we call the overnight, where we're overnighting. Day of that yesterday, day today, I was in Detroit today and Washington's Reagan National, DCI Airport, and then up to Syracuse for the night where I decided I was going to do this podcast. A three-day trip, not too bad. We usually work four-day trips. We usually work 4 days on, 3 days off. Sometimes we get four on and four off, which isn't too bad, but usually 4 days on, 3 days off. Like I said, we fly between 4 and 6 legs a day. So the days can get pretty long. They can be, 7.8 to 7.9 hours of scheduled flying time with total duty time of 12 to 14 hours. So a lot of time at work, a lot of time flying the airplane, and a lot of tiring days, but a lot of good experience. And at the end of the month, they even send you a paycheck, which for an airplane geek like me is a pretty awesome thing to do what I love and to get paid. So the topic for this podcast that I wanted to kind of talk about, I was searching my mind, racking my brain, so to speak, for a topic that I thought would be a good introductory topic that maybe something that those of you who don't fly at the airlines are wondering about, people who don't know about airplanes are wondering about, even general aviation people, and that's why are some landings hard and why are some landings so soft? At the airlines, at least, flying the airliners. I get that question all the time. Well, how come, is it always Navy pilots that land hard? Yeah. Navy pilots land hard because the landing on the aircraft carrier, you got to fly it into the deck, right? That's how it's done, Chris, isn't it? Not quite. No, that's not exactly how it's done. I get a lot of people who kind of ask me that question, and I don't always get the time to be able to explain the full answer. So today I kind of wanted to run through the technical answer, the longer version of how we land an airplane and why it's soft sometimes and why it's firm. You get the common question: why are some landings soft, some firm? Why do some airplanes make certain noises? How come they always touch down differently? Well, for one, airplanes are all different. All different types of airplanes. There isn't one type of airliner. There's many, many, many different types of airliners, and they all land a little bit different, depending on what type of extra, we call them high lift devices. So flaps add lift. They make the wing more curved so we can fly slower and generate more lift for a given airspeed. The type of flaps, the amount of flaps, the weight of the airplane. You know, if the airplane, the bigger airplanes especially, can be plus or minus 10,000 pounds, which is huge. You know, it's more than the full size pickup weighs, or probably about what a full size pickup weighs for that matter. So, 10,000 pounds one way or another can, change your approach speeds dramatically. The way they land in the actual flare, that portion of the landing where the pilot pulls the nose through the horizon and settles the aircraft into a slow descent so that they can touch the wheels down at a slow or a small rate of descent for a relatively comfortable landing. All airplanes land different. I'm going to talk about the CRJ-200, which is a little bit notorious for its difficulty to land, and I'll kind of explain why that is. But all the references I'm going to give for this particular scenario is related to the CRJ. It applies to all airplanes. The system that I'm going to talk about, all airplanes use, but the exact technique of the landing, any discussion is related to the CRJ-200. So, in the airline business, all flying, I should say, is governed by the Code of Federal Regulations, the CFRs, which are a big old book of rules that tell us what we can and more often what we cannot do, and we kind of are left to deduce what's allowable. They tell us that they give us guarantees. The regulations basically force the airlines to make calculations based on given conditions to guarantee or become as close to absolutely certain that the airplane will be able to touch down and land safely without any possible cause of danger. You know, we do our aircraft do approximately 8.5 legs every single day. Not that the pilots do, but the airplanes fly 8 legs, 50 seats. You know, that's potentially a couple hundred people every single day. We do 500 departures daily. And we're one of the smaller companies. So the amount of people in the air every single day is huge. Hundreds of millions of Americans every year, and or I should say tens of millions of Americans and hundreds of millions of people yearly traveling all over the world. So this is, there's a reason it needs to be safe. It needs to be guaranteed because of the amount of people we're taking every day flying. And as the aircraft get bigger and bigger, the number of lives at stake during every landing gets larger and larger. So the regulations require a guarantee, guaranteed performance. I always kind of liken driving or relate flying an airplane to driving a car in the fog. Any of you ever been driving late night, spring or fall down the highway, and all of a sudden you run into a fog bank and the visibility drops and you can hardly see the headlights or the pavement in front of you, and you slow down, you slam on the brakes, and you begin driving very slowly and everything looks different. You feel like you're still going a million miles an hour even though the speedometer only reads 20 or 25. You kind of feel a little disoriented. Your body feels a little different when you turn the wheel, when you look your head left to right. Flying an airplane in the clouds is like driving a car in fog. And in fact, it's more difficult because once you get away from the surface of the earth, you can't see it anymore. All you can see is white. So we need to be able to land even when there is low visibility at the airport, because we don't have an infinite amount of fuel. And we want to maintain schedule integrity. We want to be able to get you there on time, every time, and guarantee you're going to make that business meeting, or guarantee that connection, or your vacation's going to start when we say it's going to start, and not, 6 or 12 hours later, whenever the weather clears or your flight can get you there. So I always say it's like driving a car in the fog, but it's not just like driving a car on a road. It's, imagine a large parking lot, a Walmart parking lot. We've all been to Walmart, large department store parking lot, and your house is at one corner, and in the opposite corner is the large Walmart building, and there's fog. You can't see anything, hardly. You can't see but maybe 3 feet in front of your car. It's just really dense, heavy, thick fog, and you need to pull into the auto repair garage door at the edge of the Walmart building. So you need to drive from your car all the way across the parking lot, and you need to pull up to that garage door and go right through the doors, and you know, only a small margin of error there, a couple of inches on either side, and pull right into the building before you can stop your car. Oh, I should mention, your brakes are failed, so you can't stop. You can only circle, but you can hit the brakes. You have to keep moving because your brakes have failed. So that's what flying an airplane is like. We can't stop. We don't have brakes in the sky. We have to go from the start to the finish. And in this parking lot analogy, there's light poles. So you got to get from point A to point B without being able to see them, and without hitting them. And there's imagine there are other cars now going their own direction. Some of them are trying to go to the same place that you are. You can't see those cars, and they can't see you because you're all in the fog. So that's kind of what flying's like. You know, we got to do it in all weather conditions. And we got to do it with hundreds of other airplanes going to exactly the same place. You know, the sky is like a parking lot. It's unlimited. We can go any which direction we want, but we all have to come in and land at the same spot, and we have to do it without running into each other, and we have to do it safely with as much of a guarantee in performance as possible. How we do that is with performance calculations. The aircraft manufacturer publishes a lot of data when they do flight testing. Engineers do mathematical extrapolations of charts, tables, so that pilots and I should say aircraft operators are able to calculate different performance values for different situations. So, for example, how much runway do we need to take off? How much weight can we carry? Where is the center of gravity for the airplane? So where is the balance? Is it balanced too far back or too far forward? How much fuel are we going to burn on this flight? How much runway do we need to land? What if the runway is wet? What if the runway slopes downhill? What if it's snowing or sleeting? What if our anti-skid brake system is inoperative? So like your anti-skid system in your car, what if our anti-skid is inoperative and the tires are prone to locking up? What if we have an engine fail and we're trying to do a landing on a single engine and a single thrust reverser and we're carrying a higher amount of airspeed because we can only use so much flaps so that we don't add too much drag to the airplane? So we have these performance calculations that we make to determine what the airplane can and cannot do, and then we fuel it and fly it appropriately according to these calculations. My airline and a lot of other airlines use a company called AeroData, which is a third-party corporation that's accumulated lots of computer software and performance data on all different types of regional aircraft. In this specific example, the CRJ-200. And we have a computer in the airplane called a flight management computer, or an FMS. We also have an ACARS computer, which is a crew address system. Basically, it's a text message between dispatch, and it also can do some performance calculations. So we as pilots get weather conditions for the airport of intended landing. So say we're going into Syracuse, for example, today, since we actually did that and I'm here. Going into Syracuse, we get the weather off of an automated report from the airport that the tower controller makes. And that report consists of winds, the surface visibility, temperature, dew point, the type of approach, so a visual approach or an instrument approach, the particular runway that approaches to, and any equipment that's out of service, so a light that may be out, an indicator light, or the like the airport rotational beacon, which we use at night to try and find the airport, anything that's pertaining to the pilot. And we take that information, we put it into the computer. The computer makes a we put it into the computer. The computer sends that information over an antenna down to a ground station, which sends it via the internet to a computer. And the computer, the AeroData computer, makes the calculation given the performance information it has stored, computes landing performance information, and sends that via the reverse flow of information back up to the airplane. We get a message light, which we click on that message and we get a screen that tells us the speeds that we should fly, the landing distance available, the landing distance required, and then if we have to do a go around, if we have to fly away from the runway without landing, and we happen to lose an engine, if we have engine troubles while we're going around, a heading that we should fly or a procedure that we should do in case we lose an engine, because when we lose an engine, we lose a lot of our climb performance, our ability to get away from ground, get away from the terrain, which is especially important in mountainous areas. So that's the performance side of things. That's how we get that performance calculation. But for the computer to be able to tell us you need 4,678 feet of runway, they have to make... they have to input those temperature, wind values and add them to a known quantity or a predicted value or a standard value. So the standard is that the aircraft will cross the threshold, which is the beginning of the runway, at 50 feet at the required airspeed, which we call ref or reference speed or a landing speed, which is termed VREF. So you cross the runway threshold, the beginning of the runway, at VREF, at your landing speed. You touch down, the main wheels touch the ground 1,000 feet
from the start of the runway threshold, and you apply maximum braking and the use of thrust reversers. That's the standard criteria. That's what this performance is based on. So if the runway is wet, the computer will add the slipperiness add to the calculation the fact that it's going to be slippery and increase the distance. But we need, then it becomes important for us to make sure we land on the 1,000-foot markings, cross the runway threshold at 50 feet, and so on and so forth, comply with those standards. And then a little bit about the runway. Pilots make control movements, and we move the airplane around based on what we're seeing on the runway. Once we get to a point where we can see it, that is, there's marks on the runway. If you've ever noticed, a runway has center line markings, like the center stripe on a highway. But it also has some kind of blocky marks that are off center line. So on a runway with an instrument approach, which I'll talk about in a second, there's markings every 500 feet for the first third of the runway. The first third of the runway is called the touchdown zone. That's the area in which the airplane must touch down in. Must. If it doesn't touch down in the first third of the runway, the airplane must execute a go-around procedure because the aircraft is no longer in a position to land in a favorable part of the runway. That's part of that guaranteed performance that the regulations require. We land in the first third of the runway. So that there's markings every 500 feet, which is good for us because the standard values we have to comply with on landing is crossing the runway at 50 feet, which we can see on our flight instruments on the flight deck, but then touching down at the 1,000-foot, touching down 1,000 feet down the runway. The markings at 1,000 feet are called the touchdown zone markings, and the slang term is the 1,000-footers. They're big, bold, white markings. They're very easy to see, and that's what pilots aim for. That's what the guidance called an ILS, the landing system, brings you in so that you touch down at those points. And if you ever look at a runway when you're driving by, if you're flying over it, you'll see a lot of the rubber, the skid marks, begin at, right around those bold 1,000-foot markers. So that's kind of how we are able to line ourselves up and judge distance on the runway is those markings. Because when you have a runway that's 10 or 11 or 12,000 feet long, it's over a mile away or 2 miles away. For the end of the runway is over 2 miles away. So, a runway that's 150 or 200 feet wide and 2 miles long, it's very hard to judge distance when you get right down to the ground and actually touch down. So those markings help us out tremendously in knowing where we are laterally and in a distance along the runway's center axis. Large runways at large airports have touchdown zone lighting where they'll actually have lights at night, and the lights will end at the first third of the runway. So if it's bad weather, if it's rain or low visibility and we're coming in a rainstorm, the lights will help us determine exactly where the end of the usable portion, the touchdown zone portion of the runway is. So that kind of comes into play for the aforementioned reasons. And then last but not least, we have the ILS, which is Instrument Landing System. The ILS consists of two different beams, radio waves that are sent out. One is called the localizer. The localizer is lateral guidance that's left and right. It's a beam that is shot out from the center line of the runway, and we use that in the airplane to track towards the runway and align on its center axis, even when we're still in the clouds. And it also consists of a glide slope, which is a beam that's shot out at a 3-degree angle from the 1,000-foot markings up away from the terrain. And that's what we use for descent information. So we line up on the localizer so we know if we're to the right or to the left of the runway. And then we follow this glide slope down towards the runway, so we know we're descending. We're going to clear all the terrain that's near the airport. We're not going to hit the ground. And when we do pop out of the clouds, we're going to be pointed right straight at the runway, exactly on course, exactly where we need to be. So we can fly into the clouds until just a couple hundred feet above the ground, break out, is what we call it, or come out of the bottom of the clouds, see the runway, turn off the autopilot, and land the airplane on the 1,000-foot markings and comply with that standard criteria. So we know that we're going to stop, so we guarantee that performance. So the total system, the purpose of this whole system I've just described, runways and ILSs and performance calculations and driving the car in the fog analogy, the whole point of this is to take the airplane from point A to point B when the weather's bad, you can't see the ground at all, and make sure that we can do it safely so that everybody gets to where they're going and they do it on time. That's the purpose. Let's talk about a landing. The part that the nitty-gritty, the whole reason I explained all of this stuff. The landing is the part most people consider a landing, the point where the wheels hit the ground, which isn't necessarily what a landing is. A landing is five separate and totally independent steps. When they all come together, successfully take the airplane from safely and stably or stabilized flight in the air to successfully not flying and stabilized safely on the ground. Those five steps are the approach, the round out, the flare, touchdown, and roll out. So the approach is when we have all of the flaps out, high lift devices, we've slowed to our final approach speed based on our weight and current temperature, and we're coming down the glide slope. So tracking that 3-degree slope, clearing all of our terrain, trees, buildings, mountains, whatever it may be. And we're tracking the localizer, so we're aligned with the runway. So when we break out of the clouds, we're in a position we can land, and we're headed for the runway with the correct amount of engine power, engine thrust set, so the airplane is stabilized, it's just doing its thing, and we're watching it fly, monitoring it, making small changes as necessary. The round out is the point when we get above the runway. It starts about 40 feet above the runway, and that's where the engine power begins to come back, and the nose of the airplane is pulled up above the horizon line. So as we start to slow, we start to bring the nose up and we begin to arrest the descent. So we keep the airplane from impacting the ground nose first or really, really hard. So we slow the descent rate and we bring the nose above the horizon. This keeps us from hitting the nose wheel and it keeps us from hitting the ground really hard. We want to land softly on the main gear just over the wings of the airplane. So that's the round out. The flare is the portion of the actual landing where the nose is continually pulled up as the airplane sinks towards the runway and slowly begins to settle until we reach the touchdown, which is the moment when the main wheels actually touch the ground. On a big jet, you'll notice, if you've ever looked out the window during the landing, the wing has all these little panels that pop up. Those are called ground lift dumping, or GLD. They basically keep the wing from flying. So the airplane has been flying up until we touch the ground. We want the airplane to stop flying. We've landed. We want all the weight to go from the wing down onto the tires so that we can apply maximum braking. If the tires don't have a lot of weight on them, they don't have a lot of traction. If they don't have traction, they can't stop us. So we want to make sure the airplane goes from flying to not flying instantaneously or as near as instantaneous as we can make it, and that's what those panels are. So that's the touchdown. The rollout is when we lower the nose gear to the ground, we apply brakes, and we transition from landing speed, which is 140 miles an hour or more in some instances, to a safe taxi speed, which is supposed to be no faster than a brisk walk, but for large airliners, it's 20 or so miles an hour, approximately. So that's the phases of the landing. Where the hard or soft landing comes into play is when a pilot is trying to make sure the airplane lands in the appropriate part of the runway so that we know 100% what the given outcome of the landing is going to be. So for instance, on a short runway at nighttime in the middle of a rainstorm, and we're not going to see the runway until we're just above it, until we're ready to land on it. And the airplane is, if it's a short runway, it's probably, if it's wet, it's probably pretty close to requiring quite a bit of that runway to safely and successfully stop with that guaranteed performance factor in there. So it's absolutely critical that the pilot lands exactly 1,000 feet down the runway, and he or she applies the correct amount of braking and applies the correct amount of reverse thrust so that we know, even with the rain, even at night, even though we couldn't see the runway until the last minute, we were able to land on it and stop. And that's kind of where the ability for finesse, I'll say, where the finesse kind of goes out of it. When you get into the part of the landing, into that round out and the flare, where you know as a pilot you're thinking, man, I got to stick it right on the 1,000-footers. I got to put it on 1,000 feet down the runway. There's not a lot of room to try and make that touchdown really nice and soft. It's more important to put the airplane on the ground so the ground lift dumping can come up, put the weight on the wheels, and for us to start stopping. Because if we're on the ground with the ground lift dumping up, the airplane's too dirty now. The wing isn't making lift. We can't go around. We can't stop. We can't start flying again, even though we're going 140 miles an hour. We're committed to this landing. The airplane's too smart for us. It knows we're trying to land, and it's doing everything possible to not fly anymore. So it's most important for us to land at that exact point. If it's clear blue in a million, the runway is 12,500 feet long. It's a little more than 2 miles long. It's visual conditions. There's a lot more room for finesse. Pilots have more discretion in trying to lighten that actual touchdown. And in fact, we usually have a lot of pride at stake. We like to do that, to give you guys a smooth ride in the back of the airplane, or give the people, I should say, a smooth ride in the back of the airplane. So that is the reason why some landings are soft and some landings are firm. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this little discussion here. I'm looking forward to making some more episodes. Leave some comments, leave some feedback. Tell me what you want to hear next. Tell me what you enjoyed, what you didn't enjoy, and hopefully we can make a couple more episodes and get into maybe some fun, some humor next time, start sharing some stories, some experiences, talk about some new things, some new topics, and it'll be a lot of fun moving forward. So thanks for joining me. I've enjoyed doing this. I look forward to doing the next one, and hope everybody enjoys the rest of your week.